All right, everyone, seeing as how the recording has started, we are a few minutes early here, but I am going to just kick us off with our quick housekeeping rules for today as attendees filter into the room. So on behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, ITRC Vapor Intrusion Mitigation Session 1. My name is Devin Sechkar. I'm your moderator today from Washington, D.C. This training is an introduction to the ITRC online resources, technical resources for vapor intrusion mitigation produced by ITRC in 2021. This training webinar is a two-part series. This is the first session with the next, I believe, following on next Tuesday on June 6th. So we look forward to seeing everybody in the second part of this training on next Tuesday. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. Some housekeeping rules for today. This training is being recorded for those not able to join us live and will be offered on demand. The CLUIN training page offers the slides available for download under download training materials if you would like to refer to them at a later time or roll through them at your own pace during today's training. The Q&A box is available to ask questions, make comments, or report any technical problems that you may encounter during today's training. We will have two question and answer breaks during the training today, the first about halfway through with the second at the end of all of our modules. For those interested in receiving certificates of completion, they are available at the end of the course. Once you fill out the feedback form, you have an opportunity at the end to check a box to certify that you participated and to request a certificate of completion. And then it will be provided to you. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of States. ITRC is a state-led organization composed of members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. ITRC members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses such as the one you're participating on today. If you would like to be a part of ITRC, we encourage you to visit our website to learn more about how you can become a member, join active teams, and just take advantage of all of the wonderful resources that our teams have produced. The full ITRC disclaimer is also available on our website. If you do plan to use any ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy and be sure to credit ITRC accordingly. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. So with that, I have the pleasure of introducing our expert trainers joining us today for our first session of vapor intrusion mitigation. All of our trainers serve as members of the vapor intrusion mitigation team and have volunteered to support the training offered today. So with that, I'm going to hand it off to Kelly Johnson from the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality to get us oriented on today's training with our introduction.
Excellent. Thank you, Devin. Hello, everybody. I'm Kelly Johnson. As Devin mentioned, I'm with the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality. I act as the Brownfields Vapor Intrusion Specialist. Me and Matt Williams were the team leads for this team. And I'll give you the introduction today before I hand it off for the conceptual site models portion. I'm going to turn off my camera just to keep things, make sure it flows all right. So again, as Devin mentioned, today is just the session one of two. And for today, we're going to cover the conceptual site models for vapor intrusion mitigation, talk about public outreach during vapor intrusion mitigation, rapid response and ventilation outreach materials, and then the remediation and institutional controls as vapor intrusion mitigation outreach materials. Sorry about that. And just a quick background here, in today's session, we'll give you a quick background on the vapor intrusion mitigation training team. I'll give you an overview of the available documentation. I'll talk about how to access these mitigation strategies, and I'll identify the sections that will be discussed today, which we kind of just did. It's really important to note here what is not covered in the vapor intrusion mitigation training, and this includes emergency response actions. Immediately contact first responders if you encounter reports of strong petroleum odors or if there's any evidence of combustible, explosive, or oxygen deficient conditions inside the building. We also don't cover methane mitigation or hazardous substances that have a high explosive potential. And we also don't cover radon. And while methane and radon do have a lot of similarities and a lot of bleed over between the two topics, this specifically focus does not focus on methane and radon. There's one section in the mitigation training team that doesn't have its own part in the training, and that's because it doesn't have much info in there yet. It's the emerging technologies outreach material section. And this is more of a placeholder piece in the event that more technologies, fact sheets and things like that should be developed from as more technologies come out. The one that's currently in there is the aerobic vapor mitigation barriers, which create an aerobic bio barrier for petroleum vapors. And again, this is really mostly a placeholder in the emerging technologies outreach part. A quick background on how the mitigation training team came about. There's the previous ITRC guidance documents really focused on the investigative process. There's on the right there, you've got the January 2007 practical guideline. It's a little dated now, but a lot of the information is still good. And I think, honestly, most states still reference that as well. And then there's the petroleum vapor intrusion document from October 2014. If you're not familiar with those, I highly encourage you to get to them, especially the petroleum vapor intrusion document there. If you go back to the appendices, there's a lot more information there than you might expect on investigation and sampling and things like that. And one common comment through training for both of these offerings here was a lot of requests for additional details and training on the mitigation components. And so that's how this team initially started. Now, we're not going to give you a full 101 here on vapor intrusion. We're kind of assuming that you've got some experience with it, but just to make sure everybody's at least on solid ground, what is vapor intrusion? It's when contaminants in soil and groundwater volatilize into soil gas. And vapor intrusion occurs when these vapors migrate upward into the overlying buildings and contaminate indoor air, pose a health risk. If present at sufficiently high concentrations, these vapors may present a threat to the health and safety of the building occupants. And there on the right, you've got just a couple quick diagram figures there that one is a commercial environment with a slightly seated into the ground there, a residential one in the middle, and then a slab on grade to the right. But they've got contamination below and the vapors, the little arrows are the soil gas migrating upward. There's two different types of vapor intrusion here. There's chlorinated vapor intrusion, which addresses the chlorinated compounds. And then there's petroleum vapor intrusion, which is a subset of VI that deals exclusively with the petroleum hydrocarbon contaminants. There's a lot of common themes between the two. There is a little bit difference in how they'll behave in the subsurface or migrate, especially for distances and things like that you need to be concerned with from away from it. But a lot of the mitigation approaches, or especially the technologies, are very similar. But it might help you, depending on your contaminant, you might pick different strategies. Vapor intrusion mitigation itself is implemented to reduce indoor air contaminants due to vapor intrusion below applicable action or screening levels. And this can be accomplished by modifying the vapor intrusion pathway to reduce the max flux of contaminants entering the building, or reducing indoor air contaminant concentrations by removal or dilution. And removal there would be to reroute the soil gas around the structure. Dilution could be things like adding additional makeup air inside the structure itself. And then there's also diffusion, which is where you would address the contaminants by using a barrier or something like that on the bottom there. More about vapor VI mitigation here, vapor control. VOC vapor control can include the source remediation, which is where you address the source of where the vapors are generated. Active or passive mitigation, which is probably why most people are sitting in on here. That's probably your main exposure to some of this, especially the mitigation components. And that's when you, active or passive mitigation occurs at the building envelope and interface between the building and the subsurface. Rapid response, it's mostly used to address indoor air to buy you time so that you can implement a more long-term active or passive mitigation strategy. And then there's also the institutional controls, which will place legal or regulatory requirements on a property to prevent exposure. Not to go through the whole thing, but just to kind of set the framework for some of the items in session one here today and session two next week, it's real important to keep in mind throughout the vapor intrusion mitigation process some of the important steps. There's the pre-system installation items, where, of course, you need to have a thorough and appropriate assessment of the site conditions. And Dave will talk about some of that in the conceptual site model part. That'll lead into your technology selection for how to address and protect public health. And then there's the develop and document of the system design. And depending on where you are, that could include submitting your design for regulatory approval and things like that. Once you get past some of those pieces there, you get to the actual system installation. The pre-construction meeting can't be stressed enough in terms of making sure that everybody's on board. You really can't have a plumber out there that doesn't understand what you're doing when you're doing mitigation and bypass or make preferential pathways through what you're trying to do, which does happen quite commonly, actually. You've got the actual installation itself of the system. And then number six is incredibly important, which is the oversight component, the quality control out there to make sure nothing gets covered up without looking at it. And then once you get past some of those steps, you've got the post-system installation, which is the more long-term issues. Once you've got the slab poured, if this was a new building, you know, there are or retrofitting, you've got system verification, additional inspections, verification sampling, which could include sub-slab or indoor air sampling, and then confirming performance QA/QC. That could be things like collecting pressure measurements. And again, a lot of this will get covered, I believe, in session two, and there's more details on the active and passive approaches. There's documentation, which could include submitting documents at the end here for regulatory review and things like that. And then the long-term operation, maintenance, and monitoring. In the bottom right there, there's a hyperlink. You can't click it, of course, because it's a screen here. But if you go to that webpage, I highly encourage you to throughout session one and two. If you go to that webpage there through ITRC and scroll down, you'll see this document interactive directory map here on the right side of the screen. And those blue boxes that say fact sheet and checklist and things like that, you can click those. It'll take you right there to that specific item. And then if you scroll back up to the top of that page, you'll be able to click to go back to take you back to this interactive map. And it's very handy to be able to get to the information quickly and look at it and jump back as you get more. And I highly encourage you to kind of have that up as you go through these two sessions. And part of this team here, we developed fact sheets, technology information sheets. There's a really good flow chart for vapor intrusion mitigation conceptual site model development. Dave will talk about that here coming up in the next piece. There's considerations and impacts of the various vapor intrusion mitigation approaches. There's checklists, and there's also additional information. There's a lot in there. It's designed. If you have any experience with VI, you quickly learn that there is no simple or fast way to do this. It gets complex fast, but this is set up about as best as it can be. And it's got some really good infos you'll see. A quick little background here, the process fact sheets in there on the left side of the screen here is a little zoom in on that interactive map there. So I went back one slide here and then the middle bottom of that interactive map, it's kind of zoom in here for the design considerations fact sheets or the process fact sheets. We adopted the Harvey Ball system. If you've seen Consumer Reports, it's kind of the same here. If you go through there, the idea here is to get you up to speed fast, and especially an idea of what's important for each item here. As an example here, you've got a category, the vapor intrusion conceptual site model considerations. You've got a principal consideration. Here's the example is vapor source and concentration, and a more specific subject matter, like vapor source and concentration, or if you go below, subgrade soil type. And you've got a high impact, medium impact, and low impact. And an additional, there's more information for each of these when you go to it. As an example of the more additional information for each of these, if you scroll down further, you'll be able to find the subgrade soil type where it's got additional information on why they're high impact, low impact, medium impact, and things like that. And there's links in there to take you to the specific technology information sheets or fact sheets or references on there. So it's got a lot of information fast. It's a really great resource, especially as you're trying to figure out approaches for your sites. There's also checklists, which we encourage you to take. You can take these and modify them for your company or regulatory agency. They've got categories, of course, building conditions and use, things like that. The primary prompt for a specific issue here. There's a prompt to record the supporting information. There's editable fields and clickable boxes, and they cover a lot of great information, especially as you're trying to develop your approach. This, and on the left there, this is a zoom in of the interactive map. There's checklist for the system design and documentation. There's a checklist for the post-installation system verification, and then for the long-term operation, maintenance, and monitoring components. And so I appreciate your time there. I'm going to hand it off here to Dave for the conceptual site models for VI mitigation. Thank you.
Thanks, Kelly. Thanks very much. And hello, everybody. There we go. Welcome to the module on conceptual site models for vapor intrusion mitigation. What we'll be focusing on in the next few minutes is, first of all, the importance of a VI mitigation CSM and what that is, what we mean, the kind of information that you might want in your CSM to enhance it for mitigation purposes, and how to use that for evaluating your mitigation options. So let's start with what the heck is a mitigation CSM. I'm sure that most of you are, if not all of you, are familiar with the VI CSM concept. That's usually what you use to determine whether you have a VI concern or not, and whether you need mitigation. So by mitigation CSM, we mean a enhancement to that initial CSM to allow you to make more detailed decisions on mitigation of VI. And it's important to realize that mitigation really involves, as Kelly mentioned earlier, somehow modifying the VI pathway to reduce the potential for exposure. And just using the same slide as Kelly used before, but to emphasize how we're modifying the VI pathway and what you want your mitigation CSM to inform you on. First, we have source remediation, which commonly you'll want to be addressing anyways for a variety of reasons, but whether or not it's your primary or sole mechanism for addressing vapor intrusion is a question you'll need to answer. Most commonly, we tend to look at active or passive mitigation measures at the shell boundary or the foundation to keep VOCs out of the building or reduce the flux in. And as Kelly mentioned, we often look at modifying the building ventilation conditions for rapid response, but also sometimes as a part of our long-term remedy as well. And then, of course, finally, institutional controls. And the important thing here is to, again, think in terms of our VI control strategies as being a modification of our CSM. And that's why we think having a good mitigation CSM is so important. So just to focus a little bit more on what a mitigation CSM might have in it, just an example of an evaluation of active or passive mitigation at the slab level. This is all information that you probably want to know before you really decide whether, first of all, you want to go down the active passive mitigation route and how well it might work. Your initial VI CSM might not have this information. You might not need it to decide that you do have a VI problem, but you probably do need it to evaluate the efficacy of these technologies. Certainly the subslab concentrations and conditions that can affect the ability of air and vacuum to move or propagate below the slab, moisture, slab integrity, building features, and that kind of thing. So these are things that you probably would want in your mitigation grade CSM to look at these alternatives. Another example is preferential pathways. You definitely need to know if there are such pathways that are that have a significant impact on the mass flux into a building. We usually refer to these as atypical preferential pathways, ones that provide an advective conduit between your source of vapors and the building without a diffusion and soil component that more typically limits the rate of mass flux. So if you got a condition like this, you need to know about it so that you can deal with it in your mitigation. One of the things I like to do is to look at large buildings to illustrate all these concepts, because as many of you know, a large building can have pretty complex conditions that either mean multiple mitigation CSMs or a CSM that's got multiple components to it. So in this case, we've actually fairly simple condition where we have two adjacent additions of a building. On the right side, we've had historic vapor degreaser releases with DNAPL solvent. Below the slab, looks like it went down the floor drain there. And we also have a dissolved phase groundwater plume that's not only gone under the building, but it's got into some kind of storm sewer with a direct connection to the building. So from a transport standpoint, we've got both diffusion, more traditional vapor intrusion pathways through the soil, but also a couple of advective controlled preferential pathways from the sewer and the floor drain there that could result in a lot of mass flux movement in a short time. And from a building standpoint, in terms of, again, your CSM and what you want in it, the right side is an older, or say original building with a leaky shell. In this case, it's got a degraded concrete, no gravel under the slab, but maybe some permeable backfill around the edges. In contrast to the left side, with the new addition with a tight shell, intact concrete, a nice gravel layer below the slab. And all of that means that for evaluating our mitigation options, because we happen to have this information in our CSM, we know that increased ventilation might work better in the original leaky building, whereas positive pressure might be something we could consider in the new addition. With respect to active or passive venting, again, the new addition with its intact concrete and a nice gravel layer, perfect candidate for active and maybe even passive venting, depending on concentrations and other conditions. Whereas in the old part of the building, we probably will need to look at more active approaches and maybe utilize permeable backfill or existing infrastructure floor drains to help us out. And where that degraded concrete is over high concentrations in the subslab, we may well have to seal it to avoid the diffusion, excuse me, diffusion pathway. And then finally, use restrictions are always something that may be appropriate, certainly to the extent that, excuse me, they require installation of the remedy and then also treatment removal of the sources in the old building and in the dissolve phase. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Laurent, who will guide you through the knowledge check and also talk more about using the fact sheets.
Hi, everyone. So my name is Laurent Levy. I am with Jacobs, and I'm based in Boston, Massachusetts. And thank you, Dave. So let's continue with a knowledge check, and the polls are open now. And the question is, what is the component of the mitigation CSM? Is it the contaminant type? The distance between a VOC source and a building? The location and depths of sanitary sewers? The condition of the building slab? Could we say all of the above, or is it none of the above? So let's give it a few more seconds. 3, 2, 1. I think we can close the polls and check. So it looks like everybody answered correctly. Indeed, let me close my poll here. Indeed, the right answer was all of the B above. And of course, since we know the CSM is a conceptual description of the entire VI pathway that's occurring at the building of interest from the source to the receptor. All right, let's move on. As Dave alluded to, the mitigation CSM can have a lot of detail, and one tool to help organize site information and select possible mitigation approaches is the flowchart that's shown on your screen right here. And you can find this flowchart in the CSM fact sheets on the ATRC VI mitigation website. So don't try to read that finer print. We'll walk through an example. The flowchart captured the three key elements of the CSM, the source, the transport, and the receptor. And as you can see, the source part of the diagram is at the bottom, and the receptor part is at the top to mirror vapor intrusion occurring from the subsurface into the building indoor air and the occupants. Oops, I'll take my laser pointer for the next slide. To see how this flowchart works, let's focus on a portion of the diagram. As you can see, there are a set of boxes which represent different components of the CSM linked with the sets of arrows and valves. So let's do an example. Let's assume that, oops, did my example start? No, oops. There we go. Let's assume that our CSM indicates that VI is occurring from groundwater. The VOCs dissolve in groundwater volatilized. They migrate upward by diffusion and soil gas within the vadose zone. And then these VOCs enter the building, either via concrete diffusion or advection through a crack or through cracks, or a combination of both diffusion and advection. So we checked all the corresponding boxes on the chart and highlighted the arrows corresponding to this particular migration pathway. And as you can see, there are also valves. Each of these valves represent a mean of cutting up the VI pathway. So for instance, consider valve P right here. Well, we could close this valve and stop vapor entry into the building by implementing one of the subslab vapor controls shown right here. And as you can see, this could include vapor barriers, subslab depressurization, or subslab ventilation, which you'll hear more about in the active and passive mitigation modules at the next session. Now, let's do another example. Instead of the valve P, you could close the valve M right here. So this time you'd be cutting off the soil gas upward migration, and this could be achieved by vapor extraction or removal right here on that box, like soil vapor extraction, most commonly biodegradation or bioventing, which will be discussed in the remediation module. So this flow chart, in summary, can help you determine on the basis of the CSM for a particular building what remediation or mitigation options are available in your toolbox to address vapor intrusion. And again, you can find this flowchart in the CSM fact sheet. Oops. No, I don't want this anymore. Another tool to help develop the mitigation CSM is the checklist. You see a portion of this on your screen. This document is also available on the ITRC VI mitigation website. And so the purpose of this checklist is to help guide mitigation planning. It highlights important factors that should be considered for different elements of the VI pathway. This checklist assumes that VI characterization has been completed, and it's been determined that mitigation is necessary at a building. So that conclusion is needed first. The checklist can help further identify key consideration of the CSM relating to VI mitigation. And it can also help support evaluation of mitigation alternatives. So in this checklist, you will find the mitigation goals at the beginning. This helps the user focus on site features that are relevant to development of a mitigation plan to meet those goals. So mitigation goals first. And then the next section of this checklist follow the same organization as the flowchart we showed previously. So source, transport, and receptor. And all the users and the users can fill in the sections that are appropriate for their situation. So for instance, if you're going to do source remediation as your goal, then the building details that you see here may not be very important. And by contrast, if building mitigation is the goal, then the building section that you see on your screen should be completed to help verify that key information has been collected. All right, it's time for another knowledge check. And I see the polls are open, so you can vote. And the question is, when is it important to verify and update the mitigation CSM? Is it during mitigation design and planning? Is it at the time of mitigation implementation? Is it during long-term management? Is it all the above or never? So what's your answer? I'm going to give you a few more seconds to make your best guess. In 3, 2, 1, we can close the polls. And let's check. Let's see what the answers are. So it looks like practically all of you guessed right. A few of you did not. And because the answer is, let me advance. Oops. There we go. The answer was all of the above. And this is perhaps one of the most important lessons of this module. The CSM is not something that is developed at the time of mitigation design and then forgotten about. It's something that needs to be continuously reevaluated throughout the life cycle of the project. Is it sufficient? Do we need more mitigation and so on? So the answer was all of the above. Here are a few additional resources for your considerations. These all explore the vapor intrusion CSM. So first, to the left, the VI ITRC guide, the ITRC VI guidance from 2007. Second in the middle, the ITRC petroleum PVI guidance from 2014, the so-called PVI guidance. And this guidance includes a petroleum VI CSM checklist at Appendix D. And finally, to your right, the CSM for VI mitigation fact sheet that was recently developed, that's on the ITRC website. I was thinking 2007 is starting to get very old. It's like 16 years. I didn't realize how long this has been. But anyway, it's still pretty relevant on some certain aspects. So in summary, there are three key things to remember from this CSM module. First, the VI CSM that you developed during site characterization should continue to evolve as your plans for mitigations are developed and you move mitigation towards long-term operation. Second, consider using the flowchart and the checklist in support of your CSM. These are tools that can help you determine the specific VI pathways relevant to the building to mitigate, and they can also help identify options for successful vapor control strategies. One note, though, these tools address relatively common scenarios. They may not include every possibility, but they can help you. They can help think through VI mitigation in a more systematic way. And finally, last key item, the VI CSM can also support public outreach. So it can help you explain the mitigation approach, frame some key aspects, and describe how and why mitigation should work. So this concludes the CSM module. I am now turning over to Jennifer Borski at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, who's going to tell us more about public outreach during VI mitigation. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Laurent. I am not seeing that I can take control here. Oh, now I found it. All right, we'll go ahead and advance. So I'm going to cover, we're going to move on from CSM for VI mitigation onto the public outreach portion of it. Let's see, here are all the different things that we're going to cover. And I'm going to turn my video off because that's just a little bit distracting for me. I'll turn that back on during the Q&A. So here, I'm going to lead you through the tour of the public outreach during vapor intrusion mitigation fact sheet. That is one of the pieces of this vapor intrusion mitigation document that we have web-based online here. So after we complete this particular module, we hope that you're going to come away with an understanding that public outreach is different from other environmental matters when we're talking about vapor intrusion in vapor intrusion mitigation. So basically we have a lot of great risk and public outreach documents that are available, and we'll show you where those are. And for our document, the public outreach for VI mitigation document, we did try to focus on how public outreach is different for vapor intrusion and mitigation projects, as opposed to just how to do public outreach in general. We also hope that you understand that outreach is necessary before you even start the mitigation, but it does continue throughout the project and into that long-term management part of it, and even into the exit strategy. So again, there is a separate fact sheet for the public outreach section, but we also included a small section in each one of the vapor mitigation fact sheets about public outreach, just to emphasize the fact that that's needed throughout the entire process. And then we also hope that you understand that public outreach requires diverse approaches, that it has to be repeated in a variety of ways, and that it really is everyone's job that's involved in the project. So let's talk about some of the ways that vapor intrusion outreach can be different. One of the first big differences is that the bulk of the investigations take place inside. We're not talking about drilling a hole in the yard anymore. We're talking about drilling a hole in a place where people are working or where they live. That's very intrusive, and that needs to be discussed in conversations with the people that it is affecting. Completing mitigation and the continued long-term stewardship really depends on continued access to the inside of people's homes and their workplaces. We need to recognize that what we're asking for is maybe routine for us, environmental consultants and environmental regulators and so forth, but this is, it's a big deal and it's brand new for owners and occupants. So this is something that we have to approach very delicately. And so it's important to first build that relationship. Also, vapor intrusion is generally more unfamiliar to people than other environmental issues. You know, VI is still relatively new, hasn't gotten a lot of press that many of the other environmental issues have, although it is starting to show up more and more in the press. But we're likely going to have to explain things more and help people understand what is happening. But most importantly, it's about the air that we breathe, which can cause a lot of added anxiety for people. We don't have a choice. We do have a choice about whether or not to turn on the tap if the water is contaminated, but we don't choose if we can breathe the air. I mean, that's something that must happen, right? This is an additional loss of control and can cause a lot of additional anxiety that wouldn't normally take place if we were dealing with, say, groundwater contamination. And while we can't tell people how to feel, we do need to understand that there is that added anxiety when we're having these conversations. And it's really recommended to be proactive in your communication, just to try to help people feel as comfortable as possible in the situation. And another thing to think about is that vapor mitigation, this involves permanent building modifications. So we're talking about holes in the floor, pipes running up a structure, a fan that's going to run continuously, probably for a long time. In the fact sheet, we included a matrix of concerns that you are likely to encounter. And we listed these and other topics as a resource for you. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the comprehensive nature of vapor mitigation outreach and some of these components. As with all projects, outreach needs to be considered early and often. Fortunately, public outreach is often an afterthought as we're steamrolling ahead with our contaminant investigations and coordinating all subcontractors and moving forward. We forget to think about the people that this is affecting. And that's just not a good strategy. So this needs to be at the forefront of all the work that we do. Transparency is really important. This is so unfamiliar to most people that occupants and owners are going to need a larger amount of information for vapor intrusion work than they would for other environmental work. And that transparency builds trust. So when additional questions do come up, these answers can be given from who is now a reputable source, and that would be you. Relationships, they need to be maintained to ensure this continued access and also continued cooperation through the whole project. You know, routine communications in informal settings like kitchen table conversations, are probably going to be needed to maintain those relationships and ensure that continued access. And depending on the community, partners or intermediaries could be needed to assist with maybe translating, gaining trust, maybe gaining access. And it may be especially important in environmental justice communities where owners and occupants may not have had the time or resources to be educated on environmental issues or may not feel empowered to even ask questions. It's important to make sure affected individuals understand what is happening to them, what's happening around them, and that the mitigation projects are intended to address their needs. And above all, we need to listen. Listening to the concerns of the building owners and occupants is really a key part of the communication. While the public outreach fact sheet document does attempt to help you prepare for what concerns might be there, it's not a substitute for determining what people at your site are actually going to be caring about. That's very site specific. Oops. Uh-oh. I went too far. Here we go. All right. So let's talk about communication about vapor intrusion. Actually, this went too far. I don't know how to go back now. Here we go. Sorry. So sorry. Okay, so after we listen, let's talk about communication. All right, so there's unfamiliar words with vapor intrusion. You know, we're talking about mitigation, pressure field extension, manometers, micrograms per cubic meter. All these things are, these are not words that people are familiar with, and it's going to take them longer to process the information. So we might need to spend more time with them communicating with the owners, with the occupants. And we're definitely going to want to leave something with them so that they know how to ask questions that they think of later. And it's not just the words. Vapor work has numerous things to measure and compare. And many of the things that we measure won't cause human health issues, but they're triggers for us to look at indoor air. So for example, subslab samples or soil gas, or maybe your state uses groundwater screening levels to trigger an investigation. The affected parties that we're working with, they can look at publicly available screening level table, a data, and see that they're above, let's say, a subslab screening level, but they don't understand that they're not directly breathing that air. So there's just a lot of complexities, and it takes a lot of time, thoughtful time and communication to help them understand what it is that they're looking at. So it's really key to incorporate explanations of the different samples right from the beginning. You know, what is it that they're looking at and what does this data mean? Also, the variability can be by orders of magnitude. The data is typically variable both spatially and temporally. Interpreting it is challenging even for environmental professionals. So it's important to communicate to owners and operators that variability is expected and how it's going to be addressed. And background contributions from consumer products, that can really muddy the water. It's complicated to explain an elevated concentration that's related to a background source. So it's important to clarify that we don't regulate those background sources, and have your partners at the local health department help with those communications and explanations. So while we're at the VI mitigation stage, we're generally past this part of the complication in communicating, but it is important to emphasize that potential confusion and frustration can carry forward into this mitigation phase if we don't adequately address it during the investigation. Okay, so when we're talking about communicating on vapor intrusion mitigation, we do want to use analogies if possible. We can try telling people that we're going to install a fan that forms an invisible pressure barrier beneath their building to protect them, but that's maybe not going to be enough. So many people are familiar with radon mitigation, or they've at least heard of it. So we've listed some states' guidance in our public outreach document as a resource for you. And many of them are aimed at the public and explain systems in a way that is helpful. So that's a good resource. We want to continue to address questions and concerns right away as they come up, and also partner up, you know, rely on specialized Department of Health staff, doctors for the health communication. And as our document does point out, it's important to include people like local health officials and others in the outreach plan so that they're available as questions come up. You know, make sure that they have the background on what the site is about, who's responsible, what the intentions are, what the plan is, so that they have the whole picture and play when we're calling on them to answer questions. So questions from the public, yikes, there can be a lot of them. As we move through the investigation and into the mitigation, the questions don't necessarily become less, but they become less about the mechanics of vapor intrusion and what is this, and more about the logistics sides of things and property values. So people may worry that their schedule or their time is going to be disrupted. You know, what's their electric bill going to be? How loud is it going to be? Who's going to pay for this? The public outreach document does incorporate possible concerns in a matrix for you. It's a simple fact sheet. A simple fact sheet could help to address many of the questions. So, you know, developing a simple fact sheet to address the basic questions might be a good approach. Others can simply be addressed by being responsive, right? Like maybe somebody's primary concern is the ugly pipe on the outside of their building. Well, maybe we can paint it or cover that up with a false chimney or something. But regardless of what the concern is, they're important to the building owner and the occupant, and they have to be addressed. That's the key piece. And this is going to serve to maintain that trust and that cooperation that you've established, worked so hard to get, and be able to maintain that. So as your project progresses, you might have to have repeated conversations with the same party a lot, right? They're trying to process this. They're trying to absorb this. They'll come up with questions that they didn't have in the first conversation or two with you. So be prepared for multiple conversations. Remember to emphasize that the reason for the mitigation is to protect their health. You know, that's the whole reason that we're there, is to protect their health. And it's important that we keep our eye on that ball right there. And we want to use multiple methods of communication. Group settings and one-on-one discussions, they both have a place. And remember that mitigation specific questions will come up that people might not have had the wherewithal to think of during the initial outreach, when the concerns about the health were really high and everything was unfamiliar to them. So leaving a fact sheet with contact information is a great idea. Social media, dedicated internet sites, those are also great resources to reach people. And finally, we need to realize that communication is everybody's job. Vapor mitigation projects have a lot of moving parts, and there's a lot of people that are involved. Every single one of those interactions matters, and more importantly, perception matters. So consider that mitigation field personnel and designers and other people that are interacting with the people in their houses are not generally trained communicators, and they typically are not trained communicators in environmental contamination. So every stakeholder really plays a role in communication, and it's important to make sure whose role is. So be mindful of the resident might not have. So it's the consultant's responsibility to inform the mitigator and the field personnel what can be shared while they're at the property and who to direct occupants to for additional information. This coordination, though, that has to take place in advance of even mobilizing to the property. You know, make sure that it's really clear for everybody who can say what. All right, long-term management is a key part of mitigation success. You know, why install it if you're not if you're not going to operate it. So we want to make sure that the system continues to work. We can't just, you know, hand over a manual to the owner or occupant and hope for the best. So different states are going to have different methods for addressing these long-term management. And it's not always going to be the responsible party. So we'll need a plan communicating how to address system issues, changes to the structure, if there's institutional or engineering controls at property transfers, et cetera. One of the best ways to encourage longevity of critical information is to just tie it to the system. Labeling with contact information on a sticker, physically tie the manual to the system, include like a closure letter or administrative controls that clarify responsibility for the long-term operation and maintenance of the system. Okay, we're going to go ahead and do a knowledge check. So go ahead and click your answer. When is it important to do public outreach? During VI investigation, during mitigation design and planning, at the time of mitigation implementation, or during long-term management, or all of the above? So go ahead and make your final selections here. And let's go ahead and close the poll. And wonderful, looks like the vast majority has selected all of the above. Close that. We'll go to the answer. So it is important throughout the entire part of public, you know, public outreach really begins to be, needs to start at the beginning, at the investigation phase. And although it's not the focus of our fact sheet on public outreach, it is important point to remember, right, that we have to do it at the investigation. These next three bullets are things we talked about, how, why, the reason and the focus of outreach might change as the project progresses. The need for public outreach is continual. So this includes making sure that the right people are educated and engaged in the long-term management of the system. So if the system isn't maintained because of inadequate communication on the management plan, then there's really no point in even installing it in the first place. Okay, here's some additional resources for you. At the start of this section, I did mention public outreach has a separate fact sheet. It focuses on the difference in public outreach for vapor intrusion and how that differs from just regular environmental work. Another good resource is the ITRC Petroleum Vapor Intrusion Guide from 2014. This includes a section on community engagement, Section 7. And then additionally, ITRC published a risk communication toolkit in June of 2020. And this is a great resource that dives deep into the complexities and strategies for successfully communicating with the public on health risk from environmental contamination. This risk communication toolkit is not specific to vapor intrusion, but it is directly applicable. And then there's more resources are also included in the public outreach fact sheet for you as well. So with that, I will turn it back to our moderator, Devin.
All right. Thank you, Jennifer. At this time, we are going to look to our Q&A pod for our first question and answer break. Just as we don't have too many questions here, I am just going to do a quick little logistical recap in terms of the feedback form at the end and to obtain a certificate of completion. So once the training here is done today, you will be prompted to go to the CLUIN training page to fill out the feedback form. So that's the training page that brought you here today. And then you just scroll down and then expand upon the feedback form header. And then that's where you will complete the form and check box to certify that you participated in order to obtain your certificate of completion. So with that, I'm going to look to the Q&A pod so we can ask some questions. So our first question for our trainers, does a heat pump system qualify as an HVAC system for the purpose of vapor intrusion?
Well, this is Dave. I'll take a first crack at that. It's a good question. I think the thing to recognize with any HVAC system is that the two ways that they principally affect either exacerbate VI or mitigate it is through the air flow, the air exchange rate. Of course, more air exchange is lower concentration, and through pressures. So, natural ventilation tends to create a stack effect, which creates negative pressures that causes vapor intrusion. HVAC systems that counteract that, perhaps by creating a positive pressure, will counteract it. So I'm not sure a heat pump directly does those, but to the extent that you are causing more air exchange and higher pressures with whatever your HVAC system is, that's a good thing.
All right, thank you, Dave. Next question, how would you explain vapor intrusion risk to the public?
Okay, Devin, I'll take that one. This is Jennifer. So it depends. It depends, right? That's a great regulator answer. But it depends on what your data is and what their exposure is. So if we're talking about we have groundwater contamination outside of their building, and we need to come in and look at their risk for vapor intrusion, we don't have data to be talking specifics about them, but we can talk about, with the help of either state or local health professionals, I would advise, help explain to them about cancer risk, long-term cancer risk, that it's basically a chronic risk, but that there could be other health effects related to being exposed to this, especially if they're very high concentrations. There could be an acute or a short-term health repercussions from having it exposed. But if you have actual data from either the subslab vapor or the indoor air, it's much easier because now you know what the magnitude is of what you're talking about. So for example, if you have subslab vapor that indicates that there could be the risk of vapor intrusion, but you have actual vapor data from inside, air data from the inside to show that it's not currently above an action level, then that conversation is a little easier because you can say, you know, we want to protect you for potential exposure in the future. And again, to come back to that it's really a cancer risk primarily, but there are also non-cancer endpoints. And it depends on what the chemical is. It depends on what the concentrations are. So it's really important that you have the data and that you partner up with somebody at the state or local health department to help you interpret that data for those occupants. It also matters if it's someone from a sensitive population, if it's young children, if it's people with compromised immune systems, women of childbearing age, or you know, if it's men or if it's elderly. All of that comes into play with what the VI risk could be for those particular receptors, those occupants. So it really depends. I hope that was helpful.
Now,
thank you, Jennifer.
This is Laurent Levy. I just wanted to add maybe one thing, which is what is challenging about VI investigations is you cannot just sample indoor air, because when you sample indoor air, you may be picking up contaminants that are not related to vapor intrusion, which is why you need to do both indoor air, generally, both indoor air and subslab vapor, so that when you see something in indoor air, you can tie it to what's coming from the subsurface or other preferential pathways.
All right. Thank you, Jennifer and Laurent. We have time for just one more question, and then if we don't get to the questions in the Q&A pod, we do have a second Q&A break at the end of the training that we will address the questions at. So do environmental factors, for example, barometric pressure, pumping, or tidal pumping, play an important role in vapor intrusion, and which factor has the most influence?
Well, I'll take a stab at it, but I know my colleagues could answer as well. Yes, of course they do. A variety of environmental factors or conditions drive vapor intrusion. I would personally say that barometric pressure changes, which cause pressure changes inside a building, are the most significant, and changes in pressure can result in fairly substantial changes in vapor or soil gas entry over a short term. I think some of the other factors are more subsurface and would have could have an influence, but they wouldn't be as temporally variable or significant in the short term.
And I would add that perhaps another factor that's important is temperature, particularly the difference in temperature between the inside of the home and the outside, because when you have an important differential pressure, the air tends to rise and create depressurization such that it facilitates vapor entry from the subsurface into the building, which is why it is important when you have those factors to collect several rounds of indoor and sub-slab soil gas data, just to have a sense for temporal variations.
I agree, and Laurent made me think of a modification to my prior statement, and that's that it's really barometric pressure changes that are most significant. So it's when pressures are dropping that you could have the greatest impact on vapor intrusion.
All right. With that, we are going to just move on to our next module just for time. We will have another Q&A break, so if we did not get to your question, do not fear. We'll get to it either via typing in the Q&A pod or addressing it in the second question and answer break. Yeah. So with that, I will look to Dave and pass it off to him for the next section on rapid response.
Okay. I'm just orienting my screen here. So I'm back again, and this time we'll be talking about rapid response for vapor intrusion, and specifically talking about what we mean by rapid response and then how that rapid response fits into the overall longer-term mitigation process, and when you might implement rapid responses, and what are the various controls or tools you have for doing that. So, what is rapid response? Well, we view it as situations where mitigation needs to be implemented within a matter of days or weeks, rather than months or a longer term. Excuse me, and we're generally doing that because of a perceived acute public health risk or a health concern that results or could result from an exposure over a short time period. Sometimes we call this an interim response action versus the long-term response action, which might be subslab depressurization or something like that. I will point out that in some regulatory situations, like I think under RCRA, even a long-term response action may be considered an interim action to the extent that it doesn't deal with the source. But in terms of rapid response, it'll be different from the final mitigation response by typically being requiring less design, something you can do quickly. You usually won't have the same kind of verification testing requirements. And more limited OM&M. Okay, so we will go into our first knowledge check to see how clearly I have been communicating all of this. Which of these scenarios would you say it warrants a rapid response? The petroleum VI in a vacant gas station, high levels of TCE below slab at a maternity clinic. This says TCE, but I believe the next slide says PCE. So let's say it's PCE levels that are slightly above state vapor intrusion action levels in an occupied commercial building. And finally, we got benzene and soil gas at a vacant lot. So pick which one of these you think warrants rapid response. And I'll let Devin pull it up when it's ready. And the majority of people have picked high levels of TCE at the maternity clinic, which I think we'd agree with. To the extent that the third one is TCE, I can see that being a concern to some people. But if we go to our next slide, as you'll see, that magically became PCE. That must have been a mitigation action. So high levels of TCE in the maternity clinic are the correct, is the correct answer. And that's because of EPA has determined that exposure of a pregnant woman to TCE, even for a short time period, could result in fetal heart malformation problems. So let's turn to the ITRC vapor intrusion training fact sheets, and there is one on rapid response and ventilation, which goes over what I've just discussed and gives kind of general information on different approaches available. And we'll dive into those more as we go along here. You know, speaking of the CSM and the mitigation CSM with rapid response, we're really focusing on the building because that's where we can do things that have the most immediate effect on indoor air exposure. And so that would be the part of the CSM that you would want to focus on for that purpose. Specifically, who's in the building, type of people, are there any sensitive populations, the preferential pathway question, and then building pressure and air exchange, because those are things that we can manipulate. And we categorize rapid response in two areas. One is administrative controls like notification, letting people know what's going on with standard fact sheets or site-specific information that you're sure you'd coordinate with your local environmental or health agency. And there's also relocation. The main thing I'll point out is that we usually think of that as moving people into a hotel, and it could also be moving people from one part of an office building to another, or restricting access to a building for certain sensitive populations. And the other category is engineering controls. And that would include preferential pathway sealing, I talked about before, not just pipes, but maybe sumps, large openings, things that allowing a lot of soil gas to enter and maybe dominating the mass flux. Ad hoc ventilation, which is a fancy way of saying opening doors and windows to dilute things. Indoor air treatment is another type of control. I'll talk about these all a little bit more detail in a moment. And then HVAC modification, controlling air exchange rate and pressures. So those are the kind of engineering controls we have to play with. And we have technology information sheets, or ITRC does, grouping preferential pathway sealing and ad hoc ventilation into one. And another one on indoor air treatment, and a third one on HVAC modification. So I'll again go into each of these in a little more detail. But before we do that, we'll have another poll, see which of these actions listed on the left here you would consider to be a rapid response control. notification, relocation, sealing and ventilation, indoor air treatment, and HVAC modification. This is hopefully fairly easy. Check all that apply. I'll let Devin bring up the results when things have settled down. And this is what you've implemented or seen implemented. I should have stressed that. So I think it seems a large number of people have have experience or have considered these various actions. I don't know if it's all the same people for all of them, but certainly if you spend any time in vapor intrusion and mitigation, you'll probably run into most, if not all, of these in as you move along. The first tech sheet I'll talk about is the preferential pathway sealing. And the important thing here is that, as you all know, VOCs can get into the indoor airspace or vapor intrusion can occur through both advective flow of soil gas into the building and diffusion of the molecules across the shell. And with preferential pathway sealing, we're really focusing on the former, advective flow. And in particular, where there's a preferential pathway that connects the source of vapors to the building and where sealing that can have a big effect on levels in indoors. Of course, even though this is a rapid response, this is also something that we would want to do long-term, and you should do it in a way that will hopefully last for the long-term as well. The ad hoc ventilation, again, is opening doors and windows, which you're really diluting the concentrations in the building. Simple as that. Weather is going to affect how much you can do that and when you can do it. And I will point out that you have to be a little careful if you have a two-story building. You don't want to just open the upper floor windows because that could actually exacerbate the stack effect, basically create a chimney effect with more, creating more negative pressures and making the problem worse. So you tend to want to open the doors and windows on the lower level. As far as sealing goes, we typically use urethane or sometimes silicone caulk. Should be done by a professional because you want it to last. Although certainly for the long-term remedies and for short-term response actions, that's less critical. And you want something that is flexible, is not going to shrink, and also doesn't have VOCs in it that you'd rather not have in the indoor air. You know, sometimes, as I'm sure you know, we can actually have vapors entering a building through sewer pipes, and that's why we have P-traps with water in them to keep just normal sewer vapors out. So if those have dried out, then you might need to fill those back up with water. Same with floor drains, which often have dry traps. And if you need it to last even a longer period of time, vegetable oil might be a solution. As far as indoor air treatment goes, we use air purifying units or APUs. There's many commercial varieties available that actually treat the air when it's already, or the VOCs in the air, when they're already in the building. One of the biggest issues with APUs is that people can turn them off because they're noisy, or close doors or move them. So they are subject to that interference. And they pretty well all have kind of a similar construction. Most are absorption based, like this one with a carbon filter to remove the VOCs, and then pre-filters basically to prevent the carbon filter from clogging up, and a HEPA filter if you have any particulate, fine particulates you're trying to remove. But a fan simply pulls the air through at a controlled flow rate, usually a high, medium, low setting, and And then different size fans have different flow rates and exhaust the clean air out the other side. The main thing to realize is that these don't magically clean all the air and result in no VOCs. The best way to think of it is simply an enhancement to your air exchange rate or the rate of clean air. If you have a certain air exchange rate, say one building or room volume per hour, and your APU is able to pull air through and clean it at that same rate, just as an example, then you've essentially doubled your air exchange rate. And that means you've reduced the concentration by 50%. And in my experience, and what I've seen in the literature, is that typically APUs will give you a 25 to 75% reduction in VOC concentrations. In some cases, you could get more, but it's probably not going to be orders of magnitude, because that means a lot of essentially air exchange. So they're ideal for rapid response, but less so for long-term. Then the last tech sheet is on HVAC modification, which gets a little more complicated again, because you'll want an HVAC professional to be working with you in doing this, but you're basically doing two things. One is either or, increasing the air exchange rate, meaning the flow of air, and diluting VOCs more, which of course there's a limit to how much you want to do. You want your airflow to increase. And the other is to increase building pressure and to keep try to keep soil gas out in the first place. Obviously, this is something that it's only applicable to buildings with a mechanical HVAC system, which is typically a commercial or industrial building, and not naturally ventilated homes. And this can also be, in addition to rapid response, this can certainly be a longer term remedy, although in my experience, most agencies prefer it to be supplemental, not the primary mode of mitigation, simply because you want to make sure it keeps running, and it's more subject to interference. So, the way this HVAC modification works is we first start with an HVAC system that pulls in clean air from the outside with a supply air fan, distribute it through the building. And then we have a discharge fan that pulls that air back out and typically returns some of that air to the supply side. The important thing being here, if this is a contaminated indoor air we're talking about, your air exchange rate is not this flow here, but it's this flow minus that flow, because you're circulating some back in. And so one of the things you can do is reduce the amount of air that's being recirculated. You can increase your supply air and your discharge air to increase the air exchange rate to dilute things more. Or you could preferentially increase your supply air, and by doing so, increase pressures in the building a little bit, and that helps keep vapors out. The other component of ventilation systems are the exhaust fans and restrooms or vent hoods and things like that. They're probably not going to be your rapid response solution, because even though they do exhaust air, they also tend to create negative pressures in that room, which can be exacerbate vapor intrusion. So be aware of their influence, but your HVAC modifications are principally going to be with the main systems. So with that, I'll turn it over to Merrick to speak about remediation and institutional controls.
Right. Thank you. So this module is the environmental remediation and institutional controls, however, as they relate to, how do I back up one slide, Devin? Okay, thank you. as they relate to the VI mitigation. And this module is based on several ITRC technology information fact sheets, which I will point out as we go along. So the overall goal is to provide an overview of how some remediation technologies can also serve as VI mitigation, do double duty, so to speak, and also to provide a brief introduction to ICs, institutional controls. And that should help the participants to evaluate the applicability of these measures to various VI sites. So we'll do that by focusing on these objectives here. So we'll discuss differences and also similarities between remediation and mitigation, because there are both differences and similarities. We will provide a description of two soil vapor remediation methods that can also serve as vapor intrusion mitigation means. And we also provide a brief introduction to the ICs. So remediation versus mitigation, what are they? The difference between them is to some extent a matter of degree. There is no clear demarcation line. Nevertheless, some key features can be distinguished. And one of them is in the goal and the means by which they work. So remediation generally is concerned with some sort of reducing, destroying, encapsulating, or containing of the COC mass in the media of concern. There are various ways of doing that, whereas mitigation is generally concerned with limiting or preventing the exposure to the VI pathway. Remediation can do that too. Generally, it is not, or it's one of the objectives, maybe not the only objective of remediation. The other difference is that remediation is frequently site-wide, and it is concerned not only with a very local effect, but also with the site-wide effect and frequently off-site effects. Remediation can, for example, remediate the source, but at the same time affect the plume that migrates off-site. Well, mitigation is generally very focused. It's building specific. We want to provide mitigation for a particular building or a set of buildings. The other difference is the time of installation. For the remediation, the whole process generally takes months to years, and the design, permitting, and other preliminary activities can take even longer. Whereas mitigation is generally a short-term affair. You know, we generally have weeks to implement mitigation. So they can include similar elements, but there are differences between them. And one can provide a benefit that, you know, can also be applied to the other. So remediation and mitigation, we're talking about, of course, VADOS zone, because remediation is a much you know, larger area. And we're talking about, as was mentioned before during the CSM presentation, we're talking about the hydrocarbons and chlorinated solvents. And the presence of those vapors in the VADOS zone and the exposure pathway is what drives the human risk, and the human risk drives the need to perform mitigation. And as mentioned before, we can do that either by applying mitigation pure or by applying remediation that can do double duty. Mitigation addresses the pathway, whereas the remediation addresses both the gas itself and the pathway. We have two technologies that can be applicable here to do that, soil vapor extraction and multi-phase extraction. which I'll discuss presently. There's a couple of things I wanted to say about the interplay between remediation and mitigation. So some remediation technologies are not specifically, or many are not specifically targeted as means of vapor VI mitigation. However, they can still influence it sort of as a byproduct. So think about, for example, about remediation technologies that produce soil vapor, such as ISCO or thermal or air sparging or others that redirect the flow, the existing flow of the existing soil gas, for example, capping. And these can have very negative influence on VI, right, by producing more gas or redirecting it. Other technologies can have a very positive influence on VI as a byproduct. For example, remediation, which I mentioned before, of a source of a plume can cause a gradual collapse of the plume. And if your VI mitigation or you're concerned about houses that are within the plume, well, as that plume collapses, the need for VI may simply go away. Another consideration is that under certain circumstances, remediation is mandated, regardless of whether you do mitigation or not. So if you have one of those projects, you'll have remediation, and in addition to that, you're doing VI mitigation. Considerations should be given very seriously to how remediation technologies may affect your VI system. So the first technology that we'll discuss is the soil vapor extraction. There is an ITRC technology fact sheet, which you can refer to. It's referenced here in the lower right corner. As mentioned, it provides both source remediation and VI mitigation. How does it do that? Well, it targets the vadose zone. It does so by creating the subslab pressure gradient away from the building, simply through extracting air that intercepts the soil vapor. If you're familiar with VI, you probably notice that this is not much different than a subslab depressurization system, which would be discussed in session two of this series. So there are similarities here, but there are also differences. SV systems generally have higher flows. They generally are deeper, whereas subslab systems are just under the slab, whereas SV system actually target, the systems target where the source is located, so generally deeper. And as a rule of thumb, they require treatment, whereas SSDSs may not require treatment, some of them at least. What is the applicability of those? I'll just mention the elements that are, typically make up a system, SV system. So generally you have some means of extracting vapor, which is either an SV well, as you see here, or it could be a trench. This is connected to a mechanical extraction system, such as a blower. That creates the flow that vents the subsurface. The extracted stream is directed into the treatment system where it's treated and discharged into the atmosphere. Some things that are not shown here, for say more advanced system, you can also have say restrictions on the inflow through the surface, such as low permeability barriers or inlet wells, and those means are generally directed at obtaining a particular flow pattern that you want. What's the applicability of it, of this? Well, it works if we have a significant vadose zone, right? If the groundwater table is very close to the floor of the building, then there is no room for the installation, and SV is simply not applicable. Also, it works relatively well in relatively uniform type of subsurface with relatively high permeability. Media such as clay are not really well suited for it. the important thing with this is that VI mitigation and remediation frequently have very different exit strategies. And that's something that has to be considered very seriously when you're considering using an SVE system as a means of VI mitigation. Because SVE is generally directed at obtaining particular cleanup levels in the soil, which you generally measure by simply taking soil samples. Whereas VI mitigation, of course, is directed at interrupting the pathway into the building. So you may achieve the SVE goal, but still not achieve the VI mitigation goal. So that has to be considered when you're using these systems. Again, SVE systems for remediation can be very large, complicated, and require a lot of time. That's not really applicable here. For VI mitigations, we're talking about small systems that can be very readily installed in a matter of weeks, maybe even repurposed systems from another site. The next technology is multi-phase extraction, MPE. It's very similar in its effect and action to SVE. It also extracts soil vapor and thus creates a flow away from the building. The difference is that unlike SVE, it can deal with low unsaturated thicknesses, because it includes, in addition to extracting vapor, you can also extract liquid and create a drawdown under the building, sort of making your own vadose zone. Another complication with this as compared to SVE is that extraction of liquid will definitely require treatment and permitting and discharge. So that's another complication. It is very similar with respect to the end goals. Just like with the SVE, you have to really consider very carefully what your end point is. You may remediate your site to the remediation goals, but you may still have a VI issue. So we're going to advance now to the subject of institutional controls, ICs. There's also a technology sheet that you can use to get more details on it. And we'll start with a poll, essentially just testing the experience of the participants with institutional controls. So have you ever been involved with a site that has a deed restriction or land use control or any other means like that as part of the VI mitigation strategy? And if so, which one? Construction requirements, like for example, particular soil groundwater handling procedures, building type, maybe prohibiting particular use, occupancy, prohibiting particular type of occupancy, maybe daycares or something like that. Requiring active or passing vapor mitigation, restricting groundwater use, others. Okay, so it looks like, yeah, we have quite a few responses, and looks like many participants have experience with those. That's because ICs are very commonly used with VI mitigation, either by themselves or in conjunction with other technologies. Okay, we can close the poll. Okay, so as I mentioned, there is a technology sheet with this document that we just developed. There is also an older ITRC document that you see on the left, that provides guidance for general guidance for ICs, maybe not specific to the vapor intrusion. What ICs are, they're long-term measures that provide protection from exposure to contaminants and assurance that the VI mitigation system be maintained. So they are legal measures. They're not technical measures. And as I mentioned before, they can be applied either by themselves or in conjunction with other methods, like subpoint number two with the mitigation system. They can generally be divided into those four categories that you see here. So I'll briefly talk about these categories and give you an example of how each of those categories may play into a VI issue. So government controls, they're usually implemented and enforced by the state, and they include state or federal government. They include such things as zoning ordinances, groundwater use or drilling limitations, land development regulations, and so on. They can be also enforced by a local government, of course. So an example of government control being applied for the VI may be a building code, a local building code, where certain activities, like, for example, remodeling or construction of a building, would not be permitted if we have a VI issue. Then there are proprietary controls, and those are based in a real property law. They can be implemented between two parties, either with or without the interface with the government. And they generally run with the land, so they're kind of permanently enshrined in the deed of the property. So those are things like, for example, easements, covenants, restrictions, or conservation easements. So an example of an influence of this particular IC on the VI is, for example, an agreement between two parties where one party is responsible for the operation of an SSDS system, whereas the other party is the owner of the land. So the operator, through the use of an easement, assures access, so he can, you know, come on the site and operate the system. Another form of IC is enforcement mechanism. So those are essentially administrative orders or consent decrees or similar means by which certain aspects of the property are specified. For example, an agency like a state agency may require that the owner perform particular remediation actions through one of those vehicles. For example, administrative order. Consent decree would be where two parties achieve a settlement, and that settlement is somehow judicially or administratively approved. So an example where this may come into play with VI is when a consent order requires that the landowner implement particular remediation measure, and it could be a VI mitigation system. And there are informational devices. Those are things like recording information in deed notices or recording information in state registries or issuing advisories. So these are generally not legally enforceable. However, they are frequently used. An example may be, let's say, recording a VI issue in a deed of a property or including information about the VI issue in a register of, let's say, hazardous waste sites. So with that, let's have a knowledge check. So what are the circumstances under which you may be using those ICs? Could it be remediated site that includes a passive venting system already, or a site that includes an active venting system? It could have to do with the future land development, maybe all of the above, maybe none of the above. Okay. So I'm assuming that people are voting. Let's see the results. Yes, and by all means, all of the above and more. ICs are very widely used in the VI aspect of things. Okay. So here are some of the resources that you can use to evaluate remediation as a means of VI mitigation. Most of them don't address the VI mitigation directly, but nevertheless they contain useful information about the remediation technologies. And with that, I will turn it over to Devon. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. At this time, we're gonna look to our Q&A pod for our final question and answer break, and then we'll wrap up the training here today. So our first question is in regards to rapid response, what role does knowledge of past land use, such as commercial or industrial, play in prioritizing and defining conditions that will need rapid response? Should this be a criteria?
Well, I'll tackle that one. And you know, first of all, rapid response is usually driven by indoor air concentrations that are above a rapid response level. So to the extent that past land use might make that more likely, of course it is, you know, the more contaminated a site and the more potential for high concentrations, the more likely it is that you would need rapid response. But it is driven by what the indoor air concentration is. and that's also driven by what the current land use or building use is, whether it's residential or commercial, because those will usually have different rapid response action levels.
All right, thank you, Dave. Next question. Can a combination of SVE and MPE on one single site work?
Yeah, so maybe I'll address that. In the context of VI mitigation, that probably is not a realistic option because the sites used for that are generally small. And as you recall, the MPE already contains the SVE component. So for a small site, like a single building, there's probably no need to have both. Where I would see something like that is for a very large building where in some locations you are, let's say the slab is close to the groundwater table and in others it's not. And in that case, you may use both. However, that's probably a less likely scenario.
Great, thank you, Merrick. Next question. Do our trainers have any thoughts about vapor intrusion migrating along sanitary and storm sewer pipes and interior residential basements?
Yeah, Devon, I can start to tackle that one. And if anybody, other colleagues want to weigh in on that, that's fine too. In Wisconsin, we do have a preferential pathway migration guidance document. The number is RR649. But at any rate, we have started in Wisconsin to include in conduit vapor investigations as part of environmental contaminations. And we're finding quite a bit of contamination, primarily chlorinated solvents from historical dry cleaners, but also other chlorinated solvent sources. In the sanitary sewers, not so much the storm sewers, though, because those are generally vented or slotted, but it's primarily in the sanitary sewers. And we are finding that that is a pathway to bring contamination into occupied structures. So some of the first things that we look at to mitigate that are making sure that P-traps, especially in floor drains and unused sinks, are filled with either water or oil to prevent that. But in some cases, it's coming in through cracked sanitary sewer vent piping, you know, not necessarily in the basement, but on an upper floor, or through dried out P traps in unused bathrooms in upper levels, or even through, you know, dried rings, wax rings and toilets and stuff. So that is certainly something that is a concern in the vapor intrusion world that is not specifically addressed in this standard subslab mitigation document. Do any of my colleagues have anything else to add?
Sorry, go ahead, Dave.
Okay. Well, I just add that the DoD ESTCP program has a pretty good research paper done on by our colleagues at GSI. And just a couple of highlights I'd point out is that they observe that the backfill around utilities and pipes doesn't really exacerbate the VI pathway that much, because you're still, you know, diffusing generally through soil. It's when vapors can move through a pipe, an open pipe like a sewer. And they found two categories. One is where you have a sewer that is in contact with groundwater, and groundwater, or by some other means, contaminants get in the pipe, and then there can be some movement along the pipe. And if there is a malfunction or a problem with the piping, because they're generally meant to keep sewer gases out of buildings, then that could be a problem. But if the sewer is in the vatal zone above the source, and the vapors have to migrate through soil to get to it, then those kinds of sewer pathways have less of an effect. As I said, the ESTCP paper or report has a pretty good summary of all of that.
Yeah, and I was just going to add to that. We've had a number of sites here in North Carolina where verification sampling after a mitigation system was installed, indoor air might still have issues. And there's at least two or three sites off the top of my head where preferential pathway through floor drains and things like that were found to be the culprits there. They were able to bypass the mitigation system itself. So,
yeah, and I'll just add too, I had forgotten, but something Dave said reminded me that we were just dealing with a case in Wisconsin where we were investigating offsite residences, and it's beyond the groundwater plume, but we found that there was a release of the chlorinated solvents that were migrating within the sanitary sewer pipe, creating another source area in soil and groundwater contamination in this home that appeared to be disconnected from the plume, was experiencing both a preferential pathway migration through the pipes into their home, as well as subslab vapor problem. So we're having to mitigate both of those, and that was a result of migration through the sanitary sewers, and then having a breach, which is also covered in that study that Dave mentions as well. That's also in that paper.
Thank you, trainers. Next question: if subslab soil vapor sampling is impractical, can soil probe samples adjacent to the building be useful or appropriate?
I'll just take a little bit of that. If it's not practical in terms of nobody's going to give you access or anything like that, you know, some data can be better than others, than no data at all. But especially in terms of evaluating risk to a structure, you're not going to get, you really need to target that subslab inside the building, because you want to be within the footers of the building itself there. That's closer to being representative of what's below and could find its way into the building and impact indoor air. And so structures where it's just not possible, it's not safe, or somebody just will not give access, I mean, that those are considerations to take. And then those, you know, can get tricky, but I'd be careful using the exterior soil gas or adjacent ones for full risk evaluations.
All right, thank you, Kelly. Next question. How many rounds of sampling do you typically like to see before confirming that vapor intrusion is or is not a concern?
I can answer that. There's a simple response. It depends what state you're working in. And it varies from one round in certain states, no more than one round. Well, one round in certain circumstances to seasonal four rounds. But there's no simple answer. Personally, I would say is if you collect sufficient evidence at the beginning of your investigation to rule out the VI pathways, you're very far from slab screening level. Perhaps around one round is enough, particularly if it's collected during the winter. But sometimes it's going to take a couple of rounds, perhaps a little bit more lines of evidence beyond the data to convince yourself that there's no VI. So in summary, the answer varies based on the state you're working on and also based on the lines of evidence in the data that you're seeing to make a case to the regulator that you don't need to do further sampling and you can rule out the VI pathway.
All right, thank you. Next question. What kind of long-term monitoring is required for a site under vapor intrusion mitigation or the presence of vapor intrusion sources?
That's probably something they'll be getting into next week in the next session. And the fact sheets do cover long-term OM&M of these systems. So I would probably defer to that for a more complete answer.
All right, thank you, Dave. And that is a wonderful plug for our second session for vapor intrusion mitigation, which is in fact next week on Tuesday, June 6th. So we definitely encourage everybody to attend that. If you did register for session one, you are automatically registered for session two. So feel free to attend that and more topics will be covered regarding vapor intrusion. So with that, I will wrap up the class today. I would just like to say thank you to our expert trainers for joining us today and for contributing to not only the ITRC document, but this training class as well. And thank you to our attendees for spending your time with us today. We would love to hear back from you, so please take the time to fill out the feedback form. That is also how you'll get a certificate of completion for the class. If you would like any further clarification on any questions or answered asked during today's class, feel free to email us at training@itrcweb.org. That email is on the slide here, and we'll be sure to follow up with our trainers to get your questions answered. So with that, I will just wish everybody a wonderful rest of their day, and we hope to see you next Tuesday. Thank you, trainers.